Steve DiPrabhu is a PhD candidate here at UF in history and science, correct? The history of science. So he was working with Sadaputta Prabhu on some projects related to the fifth canto just when he passed away. So he has a exceptionally good working knowledge of this rather complex and difficult topic. So we're covering quite a few chapters today. Nimaipanda Prabhu, if you could put up 5.16.4. 5.16.4, and that'll be the verse of the day. And I thank you very much for taking a shot at this.
So what do you guys know about the fifth canto, or not? You guys talked about it much? All right. It's wacky. No, everything's wacky about them two. Okay, yeah, okay. Well, you know, it's sort of, it's a little bit different than what the current cultural norms are for describing the universe. I'm sure you've heard that, right? It's a little bit, okay. As far as my background with Sadaputta and all, I was working in the BI department here in Alachua in the late 90s when he was doing the Sacred Universe Project. I was the secretary of the BI. And then we'd still meet with him. Every Wednesdays we'd meet with him at his office over in Alachua. So the guys used to work with him up until a couple months before, month and a half at least for me. And then since then, I guess you see me around with Krishna Kripa. We've been compiling all the hard drives and all the papers and trying to get something organized because he did like 45 Back to Godhead articles. That's quite a lot for anybody, all on the topic science and religion. He had 20 peer-reviewed scientific essays, you know, in scientific journals. So he was an active scientist. He did a textbook with Dr. Goel on, I can't remember, information theory or some sort of thing, computers and biology. Oh, God, it's kind of beyond me. It's pretty high-end technical. He did a lot of work in Vedic cosmology. I'm sure you've heard, seen his book. He was pretty active, Sadaputta. So that was my background with them. So we just, you know, for posterity. Okay, so that's, I guess we'll do the verse then, huh? This is the, half of the fifth canto is about other interesting topics in Krishna consciousness, and then half of it, we start getting into Vedic concepts of the universe. And this actually is the first, so this chapter 16 is when Sukadeva Goswami shifts gears, starts talking about cosmology and astronomy, and so the three verses before that is Maharaj Parikshit asking him to talk about it, and this is Sukadeva Goswami's first verse. He's introducing it. He's framing how he's going to approach it. So I thought we'd do that. I'm hopefully I get to the English. I'm working on that. So I don't know. I guess I'll read the translation. So the great sage Sukadeva Goswami said, "My dear king," that was Parikshit, "there is no limit to the expansion of the Supreme Personality of Godhead's material energy. This material world is a transformation of the material qualities, sattva, rajan, and tamagun. Yet no one could possibly explain it perfectly, even in a lifetime as long as that of Brahma. No one in the material world is perfect, and an imperfect person could not describe the material universe accurately, even after continued speculation. O king, I shall nevertheless try to explain to you the principal regions such as Goloka, with your names, forms, measurements, and various symptoms." I'm going to read the purport because I'm a hog. So, because there's a lot in here packed. "The material world is only 1/4 of the Supreme Personality of Godhead's creation, but it is unlimited." What's 1/4 of unlimited? Yeah, so you know, you're dealing with some wacky constructs. Well, I mean, not, you know, in the sense of just, you know, here I am and here's the table. I got that grasped. You know, it's pretty wild stuff. And impossible for anyone to know or describe, even with the qualifications of a life as long as that of Lord Brahma, who lives for millions and millions of years, if not longer. Modern scientists and astronomers try to explain the cosmic situation and the vastness of space, and some of them believe, oh, now we're getting into the stars. I might come back to the stars, but he's talking about the star, glittering stars as different suns. We're going to come back to that a little later. Oh, yeah. You think the only wacky stars are in the National Enquirer, just wait till you read the Srimad Bhagavatam. Okay, so he's talking about that. Therefore, it is natural to conclude the universe extends. Okay, Śrīla Śukadeva Goswami admitted that to give full details of this expansive material universe would be impossible, but nevertheless, he wanted to give the king as much knowledge as he had received through the Parampara system. We should conclude that if one cannot comprehend the material expansions of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, one can certainly not estimate the expansiveness of the spiritual world. And there's a nice verse from Brahma Samhita. It's not in English, so I'll move on. The limits of the expansions of Govinda, the Supreme Personality, so I guess this is a take on the Brahma Samhita. The limits of the expansion of Govinda, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, cannot be estimated by anyone, even a person as perfect as Brahma. Not to speak of the tiny scientists whose senses and instruments are all imperfect, who cannot give us information of even this one universe. We should therefore be satisfied with the information obtainable from Vedic sources as spoken by authorities like Sukadeva Goswami. Okie doke. So, one thing is, this is mentioned like about 2-3 times, even Lord Brahma doesn't have a grasp on this perfectly. And as far as a jiva, that would be the most faculties afforded to a jiva would be the position, according to the Vedic, you know, we're going to look at this as, this is an authentic presentation. So according to this presentation, you can, a jiva, such as most of us in this room, could not exceed the faculties afforded to Lord Brahma to deal with the material energy. And he is the cosmic overlord, you know, the celestial deity of this universe, the engineer. And even he, it sometimes escapes his grasp, the complexity of it. I've also heard statements, even Krishna is amazed by his own energy. We have the Agasura demon pastime comes to mind. I've heard said Krishna's, you know, we don't have this static concept of reality that somehow perfection means nothing changes in some sense that, you know, like the material sense, nothing changes. We don't. It's not really a big thing in our philosophy if it's there at all. What we do hear is how Krishna's potencies are constantly expanding. Everything is dynamic. So even Krishna's creative energy is dynamic and expanding. And it's in an eternal competition with his omniscient capacity to know himself. So everything about Krishna's pastimes are dynamic. So that's one thing to consider. So it seems even Krishna's in, you know, trying to keep up with himself in one sense. So I don't think, you know, it's necessarily a problem if we don't understand the material universe in its full complexity. I will tell you, I'm not an astrophysicist, I'm a historian of science. I will tell you there's nothing static about a scientific understanding of the universe either. It's constantly changing as more information relative to the information they had before becomes available, as they become more sophisticated in their ability to try to make some sense of that information that does keep coming in as science progresses, as we see within the context of our cultural experience, there's been a progression in accumulation of evidence and information and so forth. There's nothing static about the scientific understanding of the universe. For instance, prior to the modern scientific paradigm, the science, you know, it's not. It was Aristotelian science. It was Aristotelian physics and cosmology, which was very sophisticated. Very sophisticated, but it was Earth. They understood motion in terms of the Earth being the center of the universe, and everything fell to the center. So there's this whole complex, sophisticated, laws of physics or rules of physics to understand and predict motion. Based on the Earth's in the center, things fall to the center. In one sense, the Earth is the center because for us, we're on Earth, we're looking out, it's our center. There's no question on that. But Aristotelian physics, very sophisticated, and practically no one can understand it anymore, unless you're a scholar in Aristotelian physics and cosmology. In the Middle Ages, everybody was completely well-versed in this because this is science. This is the best that they had. Everybody knew it backwards and forwards. And it had its strengths, it had its weaknesses. And it was dependent on a geocentric concept of the cosmos. Now, the other thing was this whole... It's giving me a headache. Jeez, it's too close. So the other thing is Aristotelian... Greek natural philosophy was incorporated into Catholic teachings by St. Thomas Aquinas. I guess it's around 1400, 1200, 1400, 1200, maybe. So, because Jesus Christ wasn't really teaching cosmology when he was, wasn't like his thing, there's not that heck of a lot in the Old Testament either. They don't have Moses, talking about distances to the planets and this and that. So, I mean, there's some references here and there. So when the Greek information came in, they did a lot of work relative. When it started re-entering Western Europe, Latin Europe, in the High Middle Ages, it was like, whoa, how do we make sense of all this Greek stuff in terms of Catholic theology? And St. Thomas Aquinas kind of reconciled it so everybody could feel comfortable with it because they needed something to teach in these universities, which were starting to arise at this time. Oxford, Cambridge, probably Oxford and Cambridge are pretty old. Some University of Paris, some of the oldest ones. In Italy, I can't remember which one was the oldest. But this is the start of the rise of university systems. They needed some stuff to teach for science. Aristotle had a lot of stuff. Others, how do you deal with this in terms of Christianity? St. Thomas Aquinas reconciled it to the point where you get to Copernicus and so forth. It became almost indistinguishable from Christian teaching. So that was a problem, especially during the Reformation, when you had the Catholics and the Protestants competing who speaks with authority for Christianity, for the Bible. Every little nuance became a contested issue, who really understands these things. And perhaps it was a very difficult time in human history in Europe. A lot of ideological battles, both intellectually and physically. Tough times. So there was a lot of debate. So this was the environment when a newer science started to what we considered modern science started to develop. Copernicus was very theistic. He was a canon in the church, means he was a priest who did administrative work. He wasn't like a priest who had a flock for Jesus. He was a sheep herding the sheep. He was doing work within the church as an administrator, but he was an ordained priest. And he was doing his work. He was a polymath, they say. He was a Renaissance man, a very talented guy on many levels. He was a mathematician, was one of his many talents. And the Catholic Church, they were having problems with the calendar, the dates lining up with the motions of the seasons and so forth. These were, by modern calculations, the old calendar, the Julian calendar from, Roman times, after 1,000 years, it's kind of like 10 days off for example, according to the calendar, Easter should be some, lines up with spring or something. I don't know. But it was like 10 days off. Things were getting off because over thousands of years, it just, a little bit of deviation suddenly becomes in their mathematical, it was becoming a big problem. So the church is very aware. Copernicus is working on this. This involves astronomy, involves math. Everybody, all the intellectuals are entertaining, trying to do the math, positing the sun as the central pivot as opposed to the earth as a central pivot. Ptolemy's astronomy is very sophisticated, but there was a lot of sophisticated constructs. There was an awareness we have to adjust things, from the stuff that come down from the ancients, needs a tune-up. So Galileo was working on, Copernicus was working on, he had the blessings of the Pope. He posited the sun at the center. His great contribution was doing math to predict motion using the sun as a central pivot. But he had no physics to justify it. There was no physics to justify putting the Earth, the Sun at the center. The only physics they had was Aristotelian physics, which is Earth dependent. Earth, you know. So it didn't really go anywhere for about 70, 80 years until it was entertained, it was debated. This stuff had been debated since the ancients, you know, what's at the center of. And before I get too ranty, their concept of the universe was the solar system. It didn't go beyond the solar system. When we're talking universe all through the ancient world, up to the Middle Ages, somebody knows. Okay, if I go off the wagon, you let me know. You see, he's nodding. He's heard this before. So there was no the concept of the universe was the solar system. What we call the solar system, they called the universe. It wasn't like, oh, well, maybe the universe is this, or maybe the universe is that. It was a solar system. There was, you know, that was what was on the table. You know, these are the issues we're dealing with. It's not solar system, it's universe. I mean, you know, we're thinking, well, that's solar system. No, it's universe. You know, according to their conversation, their discussion, their ideas, when they're talking universe, they're talking what we say, solar system. And that's also changed in modern science. It's not unique to the crazy ancients. It's also it's an issue in modern science too. I'll get to that, or maybe I should mention it real quickly now. For instance, 100 years ago, the universe was the Milky Way. You know, we considered the Milky Way as now one galaxy out of thousands of millions of galaxies in the universe. 100 years ago, we're in the realm of modern science. It's dominant, it's supreme. The universe was the Milky Way. Milky Way is not a galaxy, it's the universe. So concepts of universe change significantly, even in modern science. Who's to say our concept of the universe now, the word universe, is going to seem any less quaint 50, 100, you know, in the future? But based on from a scientific perspective, based on the evidence and tools that they have, this is the extent of their concept of the universe. And you get into some higher end speculations, you know, involving string theory, and which I can only really say these things in name only. It gets very colorful. It starts to sound almost Bhagavatam-like when they're talking about, multidimensional realities. These are things they can mathematically quantify. They can't test. It's beyond their tools of testing. But mathematically, it makes a lot of sense. Why should it? Anyways, it's credible enough to be a credible speculation. Multidimensional realities. Portals where you one end of the universe, you enter into this wormhole-like thing. I really can't talk these things masterly, and then you could come to another end of the universe. There's some connection through these layers of dimension. You know, they talk about multiple universes, potentially multiverse, you know, cosmos. So, you know, it's not just the Milky Way. It's not just everything they see. It's multiple units of this stuff, you know, which is, you know, concepts of these words change in their meaning according to time and culture, according to the intellectual milieu. On one hand, so this becomes a little tricky, what these words mean to the people who are speaking and hearing these words in their time. Okay, if we're having this conversation 100 years ago, we're talking about the universe as compared to whatever is being said here. We're talking about, well, how could the solar system, are they talking about the solar system? They're talking about what we call the Milky Way. It's shifting even within the modern milieu. So that's something to appreciate, to understand. There's different concepts of science. There's different concepts of what these words, you know, mean. There's different contexts. Different concepts. Okay, I did all that. Very good. Different language, different culture. So that's something to keep in mind. When Sukadeva Goswami is talking and Maharaj Pariksit is talking, I don't know what's exactly going on in the Bhagavatam. I really don't. And it doesn't bother me. Because I barely know how to, you know, get through my day, you know. So, you know, let's be real. But, I do have a appreciation of something significant going on here. Whether it translates well into modern science, it doesn't translate that well into modern science. All of it. There's something going on here. And I'm telling you, when Prabhupada got heavy, it's on the issue, well, this stuff doesn't make so much sense to me. It's not what I learned. Maybe we should change it, or maybe we don't have to deal with it. He would get real heavy. No, there's something, this is real. There's something real here. It's authentic. You know, you understand it or you don't. That's fine. But, you know, the, The tradition speaks for itself. It stands on its own. I've, you know, when Prabhupada's, you know, we kick this and that. You know, when these things are presented as a challenge, he'll defend the authenticity of this presentation. There's a few physicists here. I would recommend Sataputta's work, Vedic Cosmology, Astronomy and Cosmology. I'm not saying it's the definitive approach. Even Lord Brahma doesn't understand it perfectly. But he does have a lot of background in the sciences. He's a mathematician. He was a physicist. He's published. He has a mature appreciation of what flies for science within our cultural milieu, what the discipline demand, the demands of the discipline. And he does have a mature appreciation of the Vaishnava Siddhanta and what it means to be a follower of Prabhupada and maintain the integrity of Prabhupada's presentation. And it is a BBT book, so it's not like it's, you know, so it was recognized as a very quality analysis. So I would recommend that to just, if only, if not more, to see how he negotiated these things. While maintaining, you know, he's very respectful of the sciences, while maintaining the integrity of the sciences and maintaining the integrity of Prabhupada's presentation. So again, it gives some insight how to deal with this stuff without getting a lobotomy, you know. I'll leave it at that. Okay, it's a very good book, just to give a perspective of how to negotiate these two things on a dual track, so to speak. So that's one approach. Okay. So that's that. So Brahma doesn't even understand it in full. So that's my yak. I mean, I could go on and on and on. And as is my, I have plenty more. But I do think I might have gotten a pretty good point there. I will say one more thing. So when Prabhupada got fiery, I've been finding, I'm sure, there's a lot Prabhupada said about a lot of things. Evolution, the cosmos. And he'd be, you know, he's talking with his young disciples. These guys are young. You know, all these morning walk conversations, 72, 73, 74. These guys are young. I mean, it's not Hiridayananda Maharaj now, if he was on a walk. It's Hiridayananda Maharaj when he was like 24 and he'd been in the movement. You know, I mean, maybe, you know, we could say, you know, someone who, especially devotees who seem to pick it up at a very quick pace, very quickly. I mean, it suggests they might have had some experience in previous, you know, lifetimes. So that, you know, but in the context of this life, these guys are very young. Even, you know, GBCs, all these guys. I mean, even Bhakti Sarup Damodar, he'd gotten his doctorate. I guess he's late 20s, you know, early 30s. He'd been only involved with, he was familiar with Vaishnava culture, but his involvement with Prabhupada was only a couple of years at this time. Couple of years. And these guys were all trained up. They went to high school in the early 60s, where it was, in our time, in the culture milieu of the 60s, it's before post-modernity, quote unquote. You know, I mean, around 70 or so, there's this a marked intellectual shift, that there's no surety in this, you know, linear progress of Western civilization is the epitome of human experience and expression and realization. And, you know, modern industrialization, as good as we can get, everything that's come before is but a step to us, and post-modernity, you know, there's a sense that maybe things are a little bit more complex. Of course, that can be taken to another extreme where it's all, you know, things are a little bit relative, conditional life, perhaps. There's this relative quality of conditional life. Of course, that can be taken to extreme. You know, this is the current, this is how they categorize the current intellectual environment, post-modernity. So that can be taken to an extreme where everything is relative. So that's an absolute statement. How do you know everything is relative? You know, so it can be taken to extremes. I'm not endorsing post-modernity, but there are aspects to it that are very engageable. And anyways, here it is, and we are here and all together, and so we have to deal with it. So these guys, early disciples especially, weren't raised in the current, you know, we have to respect other cultures. I mean, that was always a little bit there. I mean, it's not like suddenly everything just shifted dramatically, but it wasn't emphasized like it might be now. You know, all these cultures are relevant. We have to appreciate experiences. There's different perspectives. It's like, you know, modern science. There's a lot of reasons for that. So many of them sympathetic because modernity was reacting to what became before. Without getting too lost in that, you know, there's a lot of things going on. These guys, I know because I hit the tail end of this. I was a baby boomer. But, you go to high school, it's, you know, this is like almost absolute knowledge, you know, and it's other stuff, you know, these other descriptions are irrelevant. It's poetry. If it makes you feel good, what the heck? You know, you can play chess, you can do religion, you can basket weave, as long as it makes you feel good, you know, this really, I had never heard anybody challenge. I wouldn't call it scientist. I would call it either logical positivism or maybe even more, this, you know, we're only things that can be empirically reduced can be considered real knowledge, or scientism, where a sort of religion of science, where only things that can be scientifically verified can be respected as knowledge. It's almost where that sort of positivism comes almost this whole religious paradigm in and of itself. Only science speaks for. I mean, science is a very powerful thing, but it's like saying only volleyball speaks for reality, or you know, it's. I mean, that's a silly thing to say, but, you know, why should our senses or math or anything have access to reality in total? It's a question to ask. It's a valid philosophical question. How would you know reality in total even if it hit you over the head? What are the markers? You know, how do you, you know, we are here now. You know, how would you know? You know, just through speculation. That's our philosophy. Through speculation, you cannot transcend the conditional realm, the conditional experience, to something that is transcendent. You know, it's not so far into our philosophical take. Anyway, science is a wonderful thing. Actual science is not, is a religion in that sense. It's not, and people do turn it into a religion, which is, I think, you know, that actually, you know, my religion is better than your religion, so that scientism is somehow, all right. So these guys grew up in this environment with all these doubts, they're trained, you know, this is real, and Prabhupada is challenging it. And it's not even like esoteric Bhagavatam, you know, it all the time. A lot of it's just basic philosophical common sense points, how, you know, this is relative knowledge. You can't get it to any sort of absolute conclusion through empiricism. This is just basic ABC philosophical points that are latent to even the Western intellectual history, Western philosophy. But somehow this was not prominent in discussions of these times. What am I driving at? These guys are talking to Prabhupada in the early 70s, full of these kind of doubts, full of inexperience, challenged by a whole upbringing, and they had they're presenting Prabhupada a lot of doubt, and Prabhupada, these are Prabhupada's men, and he's trying, and he, you know, I'm an old man, no one knows how much time I have. He's training these guys up to somehow carry this tradition on. So there's a lot on the table here in these conversations. It's not just a lot of senior philosophers discussing different perspectives with nothing at stake except to, you know, somehow get to a more mature understanding. You know, he's, Prabhupada is accomplishing a lot in these morning walk discussions that became the Life Comes From Life book. And I think, so where I'm driving at is valuable to actually study those conversations. The Life Comes From Life book is an edited version of those conversations. You have this conversation on the beach. It's not like a spontaneous essay for a book to distribute to the public. You know, they got to clean them up and make them into, you know, like they standalone essays. So I would suggest they're very good introductions to it. But if you go into Folio and you actually work through, you know, what they're saying, the back and forth, the issues that elicit maybe a strong reaction, the issues that don't elicit strong reactions, because oftentimes devotees get enthusiastic. I mean, as well, we should be enthusiastic. And we'll take, you know, our favorite verse and it's like, I got the football. I'm running with it, you know. Get out of the way. So you can go back and look to how these footballs got developed, and you may get some more insight in how to carry these footballs by seeing the context in which they came out of these conversations. How, you know, and you'll find a lot more complexity in Folio. I was going to try to wrap it up with that, but apparently I'm not going to be able to. All right, so I'll just leave it with this. So here's one of these morning walks. And this didn't make it in the Life Comes From Life book. This is from the first one, April 19th. The essay in Life Comes From Life actually stops before this. And because then after that, you know, they took a break for a while. They're talking about going home, and, you know, and then there's cuts in the tape. And then Prabhupada, here's what I have. Then there was Prabhupada was saying something, I think, before this, but then here I have, yes. Then there's a break in the tape. So what does that mean? The guy carrying the tape tripped and fell on the cassette deck and it shut off for a while and didn't realize it? I don't know. I'm just joking. Or maybe there was a quiet spot and he shut it off for a while because these were cassettes. They only had so much. I don't know. It could have been anything. But anyway, there's a break. They were talking, and, you know, and then there's a break. And then all of a sudden, Prabhupada just right start, you know, the break's off. This is something to consider when you read these things. I guess as trained as a historian, you look at every dang thing. So but there's a break. Then we come back up. All these scientists, they discover so many things. And then Prabhupada's talking, well, they're discovering so many things. And everybody's very, people still are as well. And then he talks about, have they discovered how not to die? Have they discovered how, you know, they're getting harassed by the material energy left and right. But what have they actually discovered? This, you know, it's birth, death, disease, and all that. You know, so that was, they went on for a while. Yeah, you know, so on one hand, there's a lot of discoveries. It's easy to get enamored by this stuff. And this is before they even invented iPods, so you can, you know, gee whiz. But, but still, the problems of life still exist. How much so far we have gone and not gotten anywhere is basically maybe the purport here. So then Prabhupada says, so you are right very strongly, vehemently. You know, this sort of cheating, we've arrived, you know, by our scientific prowess, there is no God, you know, making all these grand metaphysical statements, which have no basis in actual scientists, in actual science. Even evolution, what does the evolution have to say if there's a God or not, or if there's a soul or not, or anyways, that's a whole nother topic, without actually attacking the theory as it is, as a science. I mean, there's so many things layered into, there's so much meaning projected upon the science. It actually is not the science. Everybody speaks for science. And okay, we can say in recent time the atheists have co-opted science as a religious proof. Before that, the Christians had natural theology. Everybody does it. In our time, there's a problem with certain evangelical atheists doing it. I'm suggesting it's to that Prabhupada is speaking. So you're right very strongly, vehemently, even if it's a little offensive. Still, these rascals should be taught a good lesson. So Prabhupada's saying, even if it's a little offensive. So that could mean a couple of things. One is, some of this stuff, these attacks on science that we do, perhaps, it's permissible, but it might be a little over the line as far as, you know, a credible, intelligent conversation goes, even if it's a little offensive, or what a gentleman might do. But he says it's permissible. So it's, you know, so Prabhupada appears to be recognizing it might be a little over the line, but it's still permissible because there's so much abuse going on in the name of science. So yes, they're misleading. Godlessness. As soon as you say God created, immediately they become arrogant. You know, a certain type of evangelical abuse of science. The so-called. That is our protest. If they accept God, then we give them all credit. That's all right. Otherwise, zero. You know, really. So what's Prabhupada's basic concern here? To establish the authenticity of a theistic paradigm. To establish the authenticity of the practice of devotional service, of core Vaishnava principles of the soul, and we're talking Jiva Atma, you know, Vaishnava concept of the soul, of, you know, basic, that these things all are portals for realizing the self. So it's otherwise zero. We don't appreciate their intention of advancement in knowledge, but we simply protest against their defying the authority of God. That is our point. So all this debate we have, we want to establish, you know, the authenticity of the Vaishnava, of Bhakti Yoga, of the Vaishnava core, Vaishnava principles, not every little niddly piddly thing. I mean, that could be discussed later. But core Vaishnava practices, core, which are the mercy of the Acharyas. So, you know, we can talk about the stars, but I'm out of time. All right, that's what I got. Oh, you guys can, okay, so, All right. So I was on 16. Okay. Open your hymnals to page 49. They open the book to 49. Okay. So you guys can just do it. Well, should I do the first one? Or you want to do it? 16 was the first.
Chapter 16. Sukhdev describes geographical features and various natural opulences enjoyed by the inhabitants of the great golden mound Sumeru, which stands in the middle of Bhumandala's central island, Jambudvipa. Chapter 17. The Ganges descends from the... After this two. I'll just read two. The Ganges descends from the causal ocean because it washed the lotus feet of Lord Vamandev. It can purify the mind of every living entity by its transcendental touch.
Chapter 18. Sukhdev Goswami describes the different varsas, areas of Jambudvipa and the incarnation of the Lord worshipped in each. Hayagriva, Nrisimha, Matasya, Pradyumna, Kurma, Vara, Kapila and so on.
Chapter 19. Hanuman worships Lord Ram in Kimpurusha Varsha. Naganarayana is worshipped in Bharata Varsha.
This chapter describes various islands, beginning with Plaksadeep and the ocean that surrounds them. Puskara Dweep, it is a great lotus flower with, 1 million pure golden, 100 million pure golden petals, as effulgent as the flames of fire. That lotus flower is the sitting place of Lord Brahma.
Shukadeva describes the movements of the sun, which determine the duration of night and day. The Kala Chakra, or the wheel of time, is established by the wheel of the sun god's orbiting chariot.
Chapter 22. This chapter describes the orbits of the planets. According to the movements of the moon and other planets, all the inhabitants of the universe are prone to auspicious and inauspicious situations. This is referred to as the influence of the stars.
Chapter 23. Sukhdev describes how all the planetary system takes shelter of the pole star Dhruvaloka. The totality of planetary system can be considered as an expansion of Sushumara, the external body of the Supreme Personality of Godhead.
There's so much you can say. It's not like, it's like, let's give a 20-minute class on nuclear physics. What are you going to say? There's just so much going on. One thing I would add, I was thinking while you guys were reading, is, in our archives we found, we're going, Isadapuda and Judhakarma did under Romeshwar Prabhu in around 84, 85, they were working on a Gurukul textbook for high schools, curriculum. They got so far. They worked on the science aspect of it. And they got pretty far, but then things changed, and they never completed it at that time. Now, Irmila and her whole crew I've given it to them and they're working on it. They're taking it up further. And God bless their endeavor. Joy. But the point I want to make is at one point they were talking about, Judhakarma and Sudaputa, is how it's, again, a difference of perception. They're emphasizing, from the perception of these residents, these entities, these demigods are manipulating, the material energy in a different perception. Not only are there different cultural contexts where these words are thrown around, different bodies facilitate different access to the material energy, different perspectives on how to deal with it. So I guess one argument they were using, many of these descriptions are like that. Another place, there was another verse, and it was talking, Prabhupada was talking about, they would talk about some of these Vedic terminologies, and Prabhupada was, I think it was in the verse actually, and the great mystic yogi can perceive these things through austerity. So you're talking about, perhaps, I don't have direct experience, perceptions of material energy that are not standard to human perception, but nonetheless, but because it's not standard, I'm not going to sit, and if it's not standard to human perception, you can't really deal with it scientifically. Because modern science is, what we can perceive sensually, verify intellectually through mathematics, whatnot, or other qualified scientists do the same experiment. They can reproducible phenomena. So there is, in one sense, it's extensions of standards. So that's another consideration. There could be a blind man and the elephant phenomena going on here. We're through standard human perception, we're seeing one thing, one aspect of the elephant, whereas through alternate perceptions to what we consider standard, our reality. They may be seeing more of the elephant or different perspectives of the elephant. Like, I mean, we're just looking at this table. I'm seeing it from this side, like 2 feet away. You're seeing it from across the room. Or we can analyze it. It's material. The material, the wood, the marble. We can analyze its atomic structure. We can analyze its design, the history of the design of tables like this. We can analyze the marketing behind this table. Why these tables sell, are popular in our culture at this time. Why there's money to be made making and selling tables like this. There's so many ways we can just analyze a table. So perhaps there might be a lot of ways to analyze whatever this heck this stuff is that's going on.
Can I give an example? In the 70s, when the Fifth Canto came out, a lot of devotees became very alarmed. For example, the statement, the sun is closer to the earth than the moon. And they asked Prabhupada about this in one of these morning walks, and he said, yes, every culture, everywhere in the world, we see Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, these days are named after the planets. So that was his response. But many devotees became so bewildered they left Krishna consciousness. It can't be true when we have scientific proof that the moon is, what is it, some million miles, and the earth is 93 million miles. Yeah. So the sun is so much further than the moon. How can we say the sun is closer? So one of the brilliant things Sataputta Prabhu did in this, in terms of this perspective, multidimensional perspective, the sun is the moon is a higher planet in terms of its elevation to the plane of Bhumandala. Okay, so in linear terms, it may be further from the sun, from the earth. The sun is further than the moon, but in terms of its elevation, the earth is closer to the sun than the moon, because the moon is higher. The moon is a higher planet than the sun. So it's more comparable with the earth. And this is one of the points he explained in his book, Vedic Cosmology, I believe. The other thing I wanted to share on this regard is the orbits of the planets. Now, the fifth canto describes the planets as islands, and the space between them are filled with various oceans, right? Bhumandala. So anyway, he calculated the distances explained in the Bhagavatam between these various islands and discovered that they are roughly corollary to the modern estimates of the distance of the various planets in the solar system, which was an extraordinary discovery. Can you elaborate on some of these things?
I know there's some debates over these things, as well there should be. That's actually a healthy sign, I think, I would suggest. But having worked with Sataputta, when he's working on that, I and Christian people, who had even more experience, it's not that Sataputta was presenting that as this is the definitive, absolute way to look at it, but the fact that the paths of the orbits as we view them from Earth seems to mathematically correspond is beyond mere chance, is beyond a mere chance calculation. And so, if that is beyond mere chance, what about the rest of it? So that was, I think, his mood. He also did other books. I meant to print them off. I didn't bring them in. But Planet Diameters in the Surya Siddhanta, which is another text from South Asia, predates modern math, the sophistication of modern math and astronomy. And he was finding, what appears to be a poetic verse talking about the planets and distances, just from a casual read, it's very poetic. I mean, these guys are doing some really good hashish to be coming up with this stuff, But so he's teasing it apart. The numbers And this guy's a he was a mathematician. So, you know, for these guys who do math like that, it's sort of like, I can't even do crossword puzzles, but for them it's like doodling or you know, spacing out in front of the TV. I mean, for them it's just like not that the TV is enjoyment, but I mean, it's just like fun. I mean, Newton, there was things I saw a show on Newton. They just do math problems for fun. I mean, what are these guys, nuts? You know, no, it's like enjoyment. So for him, it was, you know, from the mathematical perspective, he had a certain access, which is extraordinary, for what that's worth. So he's teasing apart this verse in the Sri Siddhanta about planetary, you know, positions, and he's finding that if you actually tease it apart, these numbers seem to correspond with the modern concepts of diameters of these planets. Not precisely, but to a degree that defies really good hashish, you know, and everybody's just really partying down. I mean, it probably suggests there's something exact there. And he did a lot of, he did BTG articles on these as well. So anyways, it's one perspective. His shtick was finding correspondences of, what we consider advanced science in these ancient texts. So that was one of his interests. That's not the only perspective, but it is a valuable, I think, perspective to engage. He had others, Stellar. If I rant, you got a question, we got to get to it. There was, he went back, something I think is about Krishna's birth, and they're talking about, you know, the lineages going back, and they're talking about positions of the stars from some lineages should have been 50,000, you know, ancient. And Sataputta did the math. We got reams of him doing these mathematical equations on these old computers with the print off, you know, the dot matrix print offs. So if the stars were in those positions, that would date it 50,000 years ago. This is the idea. So one thing suggests either somebody was around 50,000 years ago looking at the stars. Oh, let me write that down. Or someone was in a more recent time doing advanced mathematics and advanced, you know, by our definition of what is advanced, to project back 50,000 years and calculate where these stars should be positioned.
50,000 either, or 5,000?
I think it was 50,000, this one paper. Don't trust my memory, but I think it was some, you know, because he presented this at a conference, and 5,000 they could deal with maybe, but 50,000 is like, whoa, the Neanderthals did not know how to do this. Whatever. So it's too far outside the current paradigm of what's accepted as respectable knowledge. There's no way to grapple with it. So that was another paper that we have. For what it's worth. So this suggests certain possibilities. You know, it's interesting, and may have useful engagement depending on the audience you're trying to reach. To do what? To give them really, you know, chant and be happy. You're not the Spotty Prabhu. I mean, really, take prasadam. You know, take up the process.
Yeah, I also had the good fortune of talking to Siddhartha Prabhu on a few occasions. And he explained that he had 7 explanations for Bhumandala.
Yeah.
He had given. And one of them is that it is the projection of the planet's orbits. And that is put together as 7 dvipas. And one is, if you take a sphere on a plane and you, project each point through the pole, it will make a big plane. So that is another 7 dvipas.
Yeah.
So none of this is definitive, but it is just his ideas that he's exploring.
Yeah.
And I also had a good fortune of associating other school of thought, that is Dhanvir Maharaj's understanding, that he takes every word in the Bhagavatam as literal.
Yeah.
And so they are like saying that we should not give interpretations, rather we should take everything literal, and that's all. So I don't have any definite answer. I'm very curious to understand what is the structure of the universe, but there is no definitive answer. It's just
apparently even Lord Brahma does not understand it perfectly.
So that's my question. Lord Brahma is supposed to be creator of this universe. So how come?
Because I would say meditate on that. I mean, Sukadeva Goswami is just starting. You know, this is his first verse, introduction to the topic. Even Lord Brahma does not have a lifespan capable long enough. I think at a certain point, I mean, there's many things we can understand, and if we're inclined to do this, then why not? You know, but that at a certain point is really, as human beings, is really also only so. And the most important thing to understand is the self, self-realization. So these other things can also be engaged. Now, Dhanavir Maharaj, he has a perspective. I mean, you can discuss the pros and the cons. There's an audience that responds to that perspective. You know, Jai, I'm not of that camp as far as analyzing this. I guess my initial my personal is there's nothing sacrosanct about, you know, I guess studying history, the cultural, the conversation Sukadev Goswami was having 5,000 years ago, there wasn't the same buzzwords, the words didn't have, they didn't carry the same weight. When we say universe, solar system, I'm not saying I have a definitive answer, but you know, it doesn't carry the, our concerns of 2010 were not necessarily the concerns of 3000 BC when they were having their conversation. So I'm not saying that changes everything, but you got to be careful. There's nothing essential. Like Prabhupada said, you chant Coca-Cola. There's nothing essential about the word Coca-Cola and the experience of drinking it. You chant Hare Krishna, it's non-different from the experience. So there's a lot of things to consider. Ultimately, my reaction is whatever inspires people to chant Hare Krishna. I mean, there is, you know, that's a very important consideration.
Yeah, I have one more question.
Go ahead.
Sorry. This universe is, according to Bhagavatam, not even one light year long.
Yeah.
The diameter. If we convert that yojana into 8 miles,
right,
then it doesn't even fit one light year. And the scientists explain that so many millions of galaxies, and each of them is like thousands of light years away. Right. So that is very difficult to fit all that in this one universe.
Yeah, I would, we can go on and on about that. I think, and I'm not presenting anything as definite, but I was looking at that, you know, the stars. I said I wasn't going to talk about the stars, but I will now. I was looking at the, you know, Prabhupada keeps saying, you know, there were, you know, because of the, and he keeps referring to the Bhagavad Gita verse of luminaries, of stars, you know, I am the moon. And then I'm reading for this class, I'm not saying this is definitive, but then 10 verses later, of fish, I am the shark. Well, according to modern science, a shark is not a fish. You know, I mean, it's a different species than fish. It's a different category according to modern words and criteria. But I mean, Prabhupada just, no problem. Shark's the greatest aquatic, the greatest ocean aquatic, most dangerous to man. He's the greatest. Reminds one could use the same logic. I'm not saying this is definitive, but the thought came to my mind. One could almost use the same logic. You know, the moon is a luminary of the night sky. It's the greatest object in the night sky. I'm not saying that's a definitive explanation, but Prabhupada was very adamant. It, you know, the stars, the moon is reflective. You know, it opens up a lot of thoughts for consideration. One thought that came to mind, Prabhupada is just hammering it home. You know, at the end of the day, there's something authentic about this presentation. You know, whether we have the tools to really parse them out in their details or not. That's as far as I can take it. But who knows? You know, who knows how much our sense perception, our intellect, actually corresponds to whatever this reality is that's outside, appears to be outside the mind. Even Descartes says, all he could really verify was, you know, because I think, I must, you know, he was a jnani. Through speculation, you know, really all I can really confirm is I must exist because I'm here worrying about these things. I'm thinking. And then he's thinking, because I can conceive of, then he had some other logic, because I can conceive of a perfect, his next step was because I exist, there must be a God. Because I can, you know, his next point was, so, it's fascinating. I'd leave it at that. And it's an adventure to try to understand these things. And it can't, you know.
Hi, Bob.
I got to get through. Okay. I'm not going to lead. I can't remember my own name. Sarabhijal. I don't know what the hell's going on.
Hi, Ribal. Can I ask you a question, please?
Excuse me?
I have a question. Could I ask it, please?
You have $10?
$10. My dear sir, I don't have $10. I've understood it. I think that the purpose of Srimad Bhagavatam is to help us develop our love for Krishna.
Sure.
So how does this information aid towards that purpose?
One thought that comes to my mind, you know, is it helps you to as conditioned souls, there's this innate desire to want to imitate God. You know, we understand according to Prabhupada's presentation or appreciation. There's some innate desire to want to imitate the pastimes of God as if we were the Lord's, as if we were control. You know, every conditioned soul, wants to try to, be the Lord of all they survey. That's the buzzwords. One thing, you read Bhagavatam verses like these, and you sort of understand maybe there's really no hope. It's just so wild and expansive and unlimited. There's never going to be a point, where I'm going to get it. Here's another thought. You know, and as Brahmins, or as people who are Brahminically inclined, you know, there's a lot of emphasis on intelligence and logic and reason. So the desire to lord over state may still be there. We see this with academics. So you sort of, instead of trying to lord it over through economic development like a Vaishya might, or through administrative or military prowess as the Kshatriya Dharma might, someone who's enamored by the, the Brahminical Dharma, the desire to lord it over might still be there through intellectual endeavors, through knowledge, acquiring knowledge, logic and reason. And I was talking to Nagaraj a little bit about this. Maybe another angle to appreciate is you're never going to capture God or even the material energy with your intelligence, with your logic and reason. So there could be a humbling aspect to this, to somehow come to terms. One thing this is not, this isn't a study guide for qualification exams to Lord Brahma's School of Cosmic Engineering. You know, it's not like by studying this we're going to learn how to, become Lord Brahma necessarily. Another thought is we hear in other planetary systems, in the higher planetary systems, there's more Bhagavatam, whatever that means. You know, it's not just 12 canons like we have. So apparently, there's a lot one can consider. Possibly in these other realms, they're more intelligent. They have more, there's more information. You know, whereas we might have two verses about, New York to weep or whatever the heck they're talking about. I mean, how could you describe New York City in a couple of paragraphs and do it justice? And here we have a couple of paragraphs about the land where the mangoes fall the size of elephants. What the heck does that mean? How could, in our experiential terms, one thing it suggests is the laws of gravity are a little different because trees in our realm can't grow that high. The biological systems couldn't handle it under the gravitational systems we have on Earth. But to speak of holding up mangoes, it suggests realms of experience far beyond what we are experiencing as human beings on Earth. It could be a humbling aspect to it. I think if you're just talking to people who have a general interest in Krishna consciousness, I don't think this is Prabhupada didn't come to 26 Second Avenue and says, there's mangoes the size of elephants somewhere in the universe. You have a problem with that? You know what I mean? So, you have to, discretion, time, and place. I mean, maybe some things, really don't make logical sense to us according to our experience and realization. And, we could just say, well, I'll footnote that and come to it later, and deal with what I can deal with. Go with your strong points. It's one way to consider it. I got a guy, I bet, in the back. Man in the back. Sorry. This is being recorded. Holy cow. You're going to throw me out of the movement, for sure.
I just have one thing to say in regards to what you're just asking that I've had an experience directly about, especially listening to Sadhaputra Prabhu. I had the same conception. I downloaded one lecture by him, expecting it to be just some mental jugglery that pleased my mind in a way that was just like, oh yeah, this is such, I'm understanding this great science, and it's, but that it wouldn't really be Krishna conscious. But actually, I had the experience that it was one of the most Krishna conscious times I'd ever felt, because I had the propensity to be scientific minded and want to understand these things, the scientific way. And I was having that satisfied rather than it just being a refutation, thinking that, no, I can't think like that in Krishna consciousness. And I was accepting some far-out concepts much easier and digestible way that I had just kind of pushed away before. And so that actually does give you inspiration to chant more. It convinces you in a more tangible way sometimes. That's what I experienced.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately it comes down to an individual level. I mean, I would share that feeling. There's other devotees, it's like, what the heck does it have to do with anything? You know, I mean, it's like a, you know, so I feel the same. That would be how I would approach it as well. But at the same time, you can appreciate other devotees, other people coming from different backgrounds. And so in one sense, these things are time and place criteria. Because our first responsibility is to keep ourselves engaged. And if this kind of information, this kind of approach helps us become enlivened and strengthens our Krishna consciousness, it's useful. If this particular approach works less than another kind of approach that is engaged by Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra, you know, within our, as many, you know, so it's not that one has to analyze the fifth canto and understand it or this way, that way, to chant Hare Krishna. It really, one has to sensitively engage oneself and judge the audience and give them the best you can, portals, access, things that they could hold on to, things that will give them some traction and move forward from wherever they're at now. One last thing. 500 years from now, they're not going to be talking about this stuff the way we're talking about it now. I can guarantee you that. I can't guarantee anything else. But as a historian, just as 500 years ago, they wouldn't be having this conversation the way we're having it now. 500 years from now, they're going to be talking about other issues. How does that relate to the Bhagavatam? So that's something to keep in mind.
Well, just a quick comment. A devotee asked Srila Prabhupada, is the universal form manifest in every universe? Prabhupada replied, one universe is enough for you.
Yeah, we're so small. We're so small. We're really so small.
So, Sankhya Yoga...
I am the smallest. No.
Sankhya Yoga is the material analysis of the world.
Yeah.
And Krishna discusses in the Bhagavad Gita how one is an illusion if they think that Sankhya Yoga is... they think that Sankhya Yoga and Buddha Yoga are dualistic. So I'm wondering, so we know that. We know that Sankhya, through Sankhya Yoga, one can advance. But I'm wondering how. Like, why does the analysis of the material world bring one to a point of increased Krishna consciousness? Is it because of... at a certain point, you realize that, you know, it's just so complex and amazing that there must be a supreme being who organized it? Or is it that you reach a point where it's just, you can only, you reach a limit of analysis and then you go, wow.
I think this is probably all those things, you know? I guess... like Descartes, I mean, he was engaged in 1880 in one sense. And at a certain point of reducing what is real, what can I, you know, he came to the appreciation of the self as somehow real. He could, you know, so I think there's that aspect to it. I've also heard that through empiricism, through mental speculation, through gyan, one can come to the point of appreciating impersonal Brahman. But to go beyond that, one has to engage in bhakti. So in one sense, it's purifying because it's the mode of goodness, more so than, you know, bar hopping or whatever, you know, what else people do. You know, it's engaging with the mind. It's a higher energy. The intelligence is a higher energy. It's a desire to know. And at a certain point, one will appreciate the limitations of the endeavor and look for something more. Just as maybe someone by bar hopping may realize, geez, I can really only go so far with this, and maybe there's something more. Now, from our perspective as bhakti yogis, where we actually have some, you know, some spiritual appreciation, some intellectual appreciation, we can engage all these things in Krishna consciousness because everything is Krishna and his energies. They're all meant to be engaged, just as like we may engage the table or, you know, I don't know, you know, whatever's for breakfast, you know, we engaged, you know, the stuff from the supermarket, we cooked it, you know, we offered it to Krishna, served it to the devotees. This is a devotional activity, but it's just stuff off the shelf from the supermarket in another sense. We engage. So similarly, we can engage intellectual energy, mental energy in Krishna's service. And then it becomes very much more accelerated, the potentialities for tangible spiritual advancement, I guess one could argue. You know, when it's, you know, consciously, proactively engaged. Because there will be classes of people who will naturally gravitate towards these activities. And we want to engage them all, you know. They all belong to Krishna. I guess so, sure, why not? Yeah. It's off? Yeah, okay, cool. We got one more. Well, I don't know. Whenever you give me the hook, I'm gone, man. Just pull me by my tie. All right, this is it. This is the last question. We have to move on to the next funeral club.
In one of the purports, Prabhupada is saying that the material scientists will be able to communicate Vaikuntha at one point of time. What will that mean, actually?
I don't know. I'd have to look at it and see the context of the statement. Do you know where it is?
I don't really remember, but I remember reading it. That
you book. Search it in folio, yeah. and it'll probably interest you know, to the degree that he said that. You know, the context, you know, was it a discussion? Was it a, you know, sometimes he's saying things and making larger points. One thing that just came to my, you know, maybe like Durvasa Muni or I don't know if I have the story, but they can enter the Brahma Jyoti, but they can't enter the actual spiritual abode where, I don't know. You know, it sounds like a loaded statement. It'd be good to see the context before we, you know, discuss it too much further. You know, this I've heard the Gyanis, you know, yeah. You know, so sometimes, you know, these material scientists are considered like Sankhya, you know, philosophers or Gyanis. And I've heard, you know, Gyanis may have entered the Brahma Jyoti or some such thing. It'd be good to see the context of the statement. I couldn't really take it. You know. I have heard time and again, to enter into the actual, you know, abode, you know, that requires this personal realization of one's relationship with God, because that's the activity that's facilitated in the spiritual world as we conceive of it, you know, as it's described to us. You know, it's to facilitate the loving pastimes between the devotees and Krishna or Narayana, whatever form that the devotee is attracted to. There'd be no reason for a material scientist to want to go to the spiritual world. What would he do there? I mean, in that sense, in that concept. Perhaps there's some appreciation of Brahman, you know, the impersonal Brahman as supreme, maybe entering into the Brahman Jyoti, it's also considered an aspect of the spiritual realm. It'd be interesting to see the context Prabhupada was discussing that point, to take it further. I could talk about that. Yeah.
In one of the purports, Prabhupada explains the importance of reading these topics. He told that
reading
topics about creation and universe.
Oh, okay.
So Prabhupada told that this is also Krishna's activity, and therefore they should be considered as Krishna's pastimes, just like Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan. And Prabhupada made the point they are non-different. And the importance is we should not skip. We should go through all this so that we can understand.
Yeah, that's the point. You know, it's Krishna. You know, it's descriptions by the acharyas of Krishna's pastimes. You know, I guess I was responding, you know, if Lord Ramachandra's pastimes, for whatever reason, is just freaking you out, then concentrate on Lord Nrsingadev's pastimes. You know what I mean? You know, just deal with what you can handle and move on. You know, but on a more mature level, that's certainly true of it. You know, yeah, it would be a broader appreciation. You know, I mean, you know, the first order of business is save yourself, engage yourself. You know, find where you find your strength and run with that.
More comment.
$10, man. I've been taking notes. Charging notes. Right. I can yak all day, man.
Taking the words of Bhagavatam about creation literally, what happens? If we Bhagavatam describes the south of the Himalayan is a Bharat Varsh, and the north is Kimpurush Varsh, and the Kimpurush Varsh is a place where Hanumanji resides. Okay, if we take it literally on this earth, then the China must be Kimpurush Varsh, and the Hanuman must be there. So,
yeah.
And there are multiple meanings of Bharat Varsh. From the Mahabharata, this whole earth is described as Bharatvarsh. When looking from the moon, they describe how beautiful it looks. So they are calling the whole planet earth as Bharatvarsh. And today we call only India as Bharatvarsh.
Yeah.
And from the Jambudvip perspective, the south of Himalayan, the bigger Himalayan is Bharatvarsh, which consists of 9 islands and one of them is earth. Sure. So there are multiple meanings, so it's very difficult to comprehend.
Yeah, I mean, now the counterpoint of that is we have to be careful not to, like, you know, we philosophically tease these things out, and because we've come up with some, you know, angle that is kind of like, wow, that's cool, suddenly that is the absolute perspective. You know, so that's the other extreme. But I do think, I would suggest it might be like, we are the Lord of all we survey, like somehow we are in control of what all these words mean essentially for all time. Or another thought is, our experience is very, you know, length, breadth, and width, three-dimensional. Who's to say those are the only perspectives of time? You know, we have a lot. There's a lot could be on the table. As Prabhupada said, Krishna consciousness is a science. So if you take, you know, the ideals, of, you know, these ideals of science, and then there's human beings who do science. If you take these ideals of objective inquiry, a detached, you know, there's a lot of things you can consider about these verses. If you just lock down because, you know, there's nothing static about language. There's really nothing static about language, unless it's a dead language that's written down. I mean, language change. I mean, in recent time, language has been a lot more stable because of the printing press, they say. There's a lot more written materials, a lot more educated people. So the just the English language from Shakespeare's time, you know, it's really weird, but, you know, it's very understandable with a little patience. So that was in the era of the printing press. But if you go 500 years before Shakespeare, they weren't talking English in England, anything we would understand. You know, Old English, I mean, we might pick up a few words, but the evolution of language in just England was so, because it's just oral. There was nothing concrete anchoring it. You know, it's just, you know, we see in even our own lifetime different slang. iPod. What the hell is an iPod in 1960? You know, what is it, a science fiction movie? What the hell is it? So there's nothing, you know, really locked. You got to be careful about language. You got to be careful about everything. I guess a sense of humility in approaching these topics is recommended. Not that, oh, I understand what this word means, or this must mean, it must be that. We could be grateful for what we do understand. I think we might be very small limited. You know, we shouldn't be disappointed not to be able to understand everything all at once. You're the boss. Okay. All right. Well, thank you. And we'll see, you know, if I get a letter from the GBC. I can talk. So
I don't have $10 this time either.
Oh, okay. Post-dated check.
Okay. I don't really understand what the universal form is like.